The parliament that Charles summoned in April of 1640 is often called the Short Parliament because it didn't sit in session for very long. Charles opened the Short Parliament simply by demanding money for the Scottish War. What he found, however, was the built-up resentment of the last 11 years led to an awful lot of complaint. Indeed, the king's advisors were denounced for having treasonously betrayed the king himself, and by telling the king that the royal prerogative is above all laws. What you can see is that nobody at this point wants to challenge the king directly. There's no determined attack on his government, and criticism is still framed in terms of the king's bad advisors who are misleading him, and they're the ones who really have to go. Moreover, it's pretty clear that Charles had a majority of support, at least in the House of Lords, for all the criticism that he faced in the House of Commons. But despite this situation, despite the fact that his critics were really only making limited attacks on the monarchy at this point, Charles was, of course, inflexible. Rather than negotiate, he simply dissolved the parliament in May. So it was in session only between April and May of 1640, and hence the name the Short Parliament. This was a mistake. Dismissing parliament meant that he had no means of raising taxes, and in August of 1640, the Scottish Covenanters invaded northern England. Charles was now in desperate straits. His forces couldn't stop the Covenanters. Indeed, he was ultimately forced into the humiliating compromise of simply paying the Covenanters to stay in place and come no further south in northern England. But having solved, or at least stalled, the problem in that way, it was obvious that Parliament was going to have to be summoned again. And therefore, in the summer of 1640, Parliament was recalled. Now, Charles at this point assumed a kind of early modern English equivalent to the American rally around the flag effect. He assumed that there were Scottish rebels on English soil, and this would therefore move the Long Parliament to rally around him. But Charles was mistaken, because it turns out that the main concern of the Long Parliament was to avoid the fate of the Short Parliament. It had seen what had happened before, and there's a sense in which having the Covenanters in northern England, the Scottish Covenanters, was now a kind of insurance that the Long Parliament had that would ensure that Charles needed it and would therefore have to make concessions with it. Moreover, this same concern about its own safety, the same concern that it might be dismissed without being listened to, also led Parliament to now arrest and begin impeachment procedures against the recently returned Earl of Strafford, who had been Charles's skillful and manipulative Lord Lieutenant in Ireland. He had recently returned from Ireland to deal with the crisis. Impeachment, I should say, represented a kind of trial in Parliament, usually of a king's minister, you know, for corruption or other kind of malfeasance. The prosecution would be undertaken in the House of Commons, and judgment would be delivered by the House of Lords. And they went after Strafford because it was pretty clear that he was the only man who was going to be able to get, who could potentially get Charles out of this crisis. And therefore, the parliamentary opposition, headed at this point by John Pym, decided that Strafford had to be destroyed. Moves also came fairly swiftly against those deemed responsible for the religious grievances, and Archbishop Laud was himself also impeached and imprisoned. Now, even at this point, at the point where Parliament has imprisoned the Archbishop of Canterbury and the Lord Lieutenant of Ireland, Charles's right-hand man, war is still far from inevitable. The leaders of the opposition, in particular the Duke of Bedford in the House of Lords and Bedford's protege, John Pym, in the House of Commons, had long been interested in the perks that came along with office, royal office, that is to say. They were, in other words, willing to take what Derek Hurst has called the traditional safeguard of aristocratic dissidents, the taking of control of the royal council. Indeed, what's interesting is that Bedford and Pym and the people around them had put together a kind of program of financial reform, which was intended to give the crown an adequate and regular supply of extra parliamentary revenue. But what the Bedford group hoped was that if the crown had this regular source of revenue, extra parliamentary revenue, strikingly enough, and with the Bedford group itself in power, the crown's critics hoped that royal government could now be made to work the way they wanted it to work. In other words, what these machinations reveal is that the struggle at this point is still a kind of contest between ins and outs. Those who are criticizing the crown, in a sense, want into the system. They feel that they're being held outside the door. They're not really ideological opponents to the monarchy itself. But unfortunately, for everybody, in a sense, in May of 1641, everything came unraveled. The basic problem was Strafford himself, who was eloquent and a vigorous defender of his record and of his conduct. And he showed fairly clearly that the charges that Parliament had tried to put against him of treason, of betraying the king, were pretty ridiculous. And Strafford's defense scared the Commons, and it moved a majority in the House of Commons to basically abandon the impeachment process and opt instead for a simpler, albeit a much more ruthless solution, that is to say, an active attainder,